Our special guest this hour, Dr. David Eagleman. We'll be back with phone calls with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. Let's go to the phones with Dr. David Eagleman. And also, as you well know, next hour we'll have another guest on as we talk about some things that are going on with Big Pharma. Let's go to Big Bend, Oregon. No, just Bend, Oregon. Mike, west of the Rockies. Hi, Mike.
Hi, George. Yeah, it's just Bend, Oregon.
Yeah.
I have a question for Dr. Eagleman. I want to see what he thinks, because he seems to be thinking something quite similar that I do, and the hypothesis is this. Evolution proves a creator can exist scientifically just as well as it proves a creator does not exist. I have to refer to Arthur C. Clarke, who said, any sufficiently advanced technology appears as if magic to the uninitiated. And my explanation is as we become able to perform the same amazing things like we've read about in the Bible and other historical texts, we need to make room for the possibility God was created by evolution, probably before the latest Big Bang. I know it seems crazy, but if you think about all the biblical mysteries that are out there and well recorded, they're mostly all explained if a being were moving just under the speed of light and thereby living almost forever. But every so often, he'd swing by a planet and see how his work, his garden is doing, or his people. And I guess I should give one biblical reference. I know I should keep that to a minimum, but a day to God is 1,000 years to a man is in the Gospel, 2 Peter, 3rd chapter, 8th verse. Taken literally, God's only been gone 2 days since Jesus was here. And I'd like to point out that, indeed, if we become almost like gods in moving near the speed of light and becoming almost eternal, and we can do it, is it not possible that any number of universe or iterations of Big Bang, Big Crunches ago, God did the same thing and came from dirt like we did? What do you think, Doctor?
Okay, well, that's a lot to take in one thing, but I okay, I mean, I think
But you know what he means, right?
But I know what you mean. I think, okay, I mean, I like the spirit of it in the sense that it's doing what Russell and Whitehead suggested, which is taking things that we now know from science and seeing if you can build spirituality on top of that. Your approach is interesting, Mike, because on the one hand, you're staying married to the Bible that you grew up on, and then combining that with modern physics and trying to come up with new stories about it. I like the spirit of it. You know, the next step that some people would choose to take is to leave the particulars of the Bible they grew up on and see if you can even go one step further. The reason I mention this is because my colleagues who are the new atheists have pointed out something that's pretty important and interesting, which is they said, like Dawkins, for example, says everyone already knows what it's like to be an atheist, because all you need to do is look at someone else's religion and you think, that's patently ridiculous that anybody could believe in that. And so we all know what it's like, but of course the funny part is they're looking back at you and they can't believe that you believe in the particular things. And so,
okay.
Yeah.
Good try. I like it.
Yeah.
Let's go to Towson, Maryland. Tony, east of the Rockies. Hi, Tony. Go ahead.
Hi, gentlemen. You having a good evening?
Always.
Yes.
That's what I want to hear. Okay. I have an experiment I'd like to propose to you. Okay, so you took an adult, and okay, he lived a normal summer, normal time, things he's familiar with. Now you take him and you put him not once but twice into situations where there are things theoretically he never ever experienced before. And then, you know, you'll do this one time and then you'll do it another time. What would you think his perception of time would be then? Would it still be like, okay, well, you know, he's used to things, so things, you know, time flies when you're like having fun, or you know, when you're used to it, so it seems a lot faster? Or would it go back to the time like when you were younger and think of things, oh, this took forever?
Right. Great question. And in fact, we've done experiments exactly like this. So this is the theme of a lot of what we're doing now. The answer is, the first time you're put in a really novel situation, something you haven't seen before, it's going to seem to last a lot longer. By the time we put you in it the second time, it's not going to seem as long. And an everyday example of this that we all know is when you move to some new city and you drive to your new workplace for the first time, it seems like it takes a really long time to get there. But by the time you've lived somewhere for a while and you drive to work, it seems like it goes instantly. And it's exactly for these reasons that the harder your brain has to work and the more memories it lays down, the longer it seems to have taken.
Okay, sir?
Yep.
Okay, so the third time I was saying that that again would be a new situation, a completely novel situation. Would it hold that it would be just like the second time, like if you had like a novel situation the second time, and then another completely novel situation the third time, would the behavior be the way it was the second time?
I'm sorry. So you mean the first, second, third time are all different from each other,
or yes, sir.
Oh, yes. Presumably, each time you're in a novel situation, it seems to take longer. And so a lot of scientists are working on this issue of how to actually extend your lifespan. And, you know, it's a tough problem. But one thing you can do is actually make it feel like you're living longer by doing novel things, right? If you're always going off and having new adventures and doing new things, you'll certainly feel like you're living a lot more.
You've done some work with Brian Eno, too, haven't you?
Brian Eno, yeah.
Eno?
Yeah, he's this incredibly talented musician in England. Some of you may know him. He's sort of the father of ambient electronica music. And he read my book some, and it resonated with him so much that he contacted me and asked if we could perform the book together at the Sydney Opera House, which is what we did just 8 weeks ago.
How did you do that?
It was fantastic. He wrote 12 new pieces of music for the book, and the stories in some are very short stories. There's 40 short stories.
41,
and, yeah. And so I read the story. I and several other actors read the stories over his music to an audience of 1,000 people. And we're actually doing a reprise of this in London in November with me and Brian Eno and the writer Philip Pullman and several famous actors and musicians. We're hoping to get Judi Dench there. We have Miranda Richardson. And
I hope you're taping all this, right?
Yeah, all taped.
Let's go to Manhattan, New York. First-time caller, Andrew, you're up with us. Hi, Andrew.
Yes, George, thanks for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
My question is pretty straightforward. Actually, you brought it up, George, right before the break, and I was thinking about it. Is, Doctor, do you have faith? And if yes or no, do you think it's good for mankind?
Well, let me answer them in backwards order. I think there's nothing harmful for mankind in people experiencing a sense of awe and mystery at this incredible cosmos that we're surrounded with. I think that's probably really good for mankind. The places where faith gets a little bit bad for mankind is when people are willing to fight and die over their particular version of the story, over their 1 in 2,000 story. As far as my own faith, I think it's straightforwardly the faith of a scientist who spends all of his time celebrating the vastness of our ignorance and the size of the cosmos and the mystery of our deeply strange existence here. And
faith in mankind, basically, just faith in man.
Development. I think my faith goes deeper than that. I mean, it's not just faith in man. It's faith in all the weird stuff like quantum mechanics and dark matter and multiple spatial dimensions. And, what I study every day is how we actually build something conscious out of a bunch of biological pieces and parts. And the mystery of all those things runs so deep that that's what my awe and faith is about.
Right.
I feel like scientists get to live on the front line of all that and come back and say, we figured out all these things, and our hearts are filled with awe at the whole project.
David, what will it take to get you off from being a possibilian into one of the other areas, either an atheist or someone spiritual?
I think atheism is probably impossible to prove. So I can't think of any evidence that could be brought to bear that would make me say, okay, I know that there's nothing else interesting going on in the universe.
Right.
And to be religious, I suppose that
spiritual, not necessarily religious.
Oh, I consider myself spiritual.
Okay.
But to commit to a particular religion, like if Zoroaster showed up at my front door.
No, not asking you to do that. I wouldn't ask you to do it.
Oh, but I would do it. I mean, if it happened, if Zoroaster showed at my front door and proved to me his existence, then I'd be a Zoroastrian. And if it was Allah or Jesus or whoever, then, you know, there are ways in which I could be convinced because I'm open-minded to it. It's just that there would be no reason for me to commit to any particular religion when they're all, you know, presumably made up.
Off to Pittsburgh we go. John, you're up with us. Hi, John.
Hi. Hi, George. Hi, David.
Hi.
I had two brief questions. One's about dendrite theory, and the other's about the gentleman that read off pi to 10,000 places.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I just wanted to know, I remember when I was in college, I had a professor that always stressed dendrite theory to help us to aid in memorization and memory. And I just want to know, is that the overall accepted, fundamental of the brain's function of memory?
I've never heard the term dendrite theory.
For example, when you learn a piece of information, the dendrites in your brain will begin to grow, and as you repeat and reiterate this information, the dendrites will grow in both in size and eventually they'll connect with other dendrites and form these connections that will increase the flow of neurons or the actual information in physically in the brain.
Okay, so the answer is sort of. The sort of the established theory of learning and memory has to do with synaptic connections, and these are the connections between what are called axons and dendrites. Yeah, and what appears to happen in learning and memory is that the strength of these connections changes, and the thing to appreciate is I'm sure you know this, John, but the number of connections in the brain is so vast that if you took a cubic millimeter of brain tissue, there are more connections in there than there are stars in the Milky Way galaxy. So it's a tremendously rich and complex system. And the idea of learning and memory is that you change the strength of these connections. And it's also true that animals that are raised in rich environments, they have more branches in their dendrites, and animals in impoverished environments have shrunken dendrites. So you're right about that aspect of it, that the dendrites will also grow. That is the established theory of learning and memory.
David, what took you down this path of neuroscience?
It found me. I was just so fascinated by the brain. Everything I heard about the brain just sort of sucked me into the vortex. And fundamentally, if you want to know what's going on in the outside world, you have to understand the perceptual machinery by which we view the world, because it turns out that your brain really constructs what's out there. For example, you probably know color doesn't actually exist. All that's out there is electromagnetic radiation of different wavelengths, and that hits your retina at the back of your eye and turns into electrical and chemical signals in your brain, and you experience colors, but your brain's completely making that up. And as I mentioned before, your brain also makes up time, and vision in general is made up. In fact, you may know this, but you don't even need your eyes for vision, right? Because when you dream at night, your eyes are closed and you're having full, rich visual experience. Yeah, and so what that indicates is it's all about internal activity within your brain. It's not really about what's out there.
Okay, we go to Alameda, California. Linda, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi, gentlemen, and thank you so much for such a wonderful, wonderful show. I have two questions. I'm totally blind from birth, and we're just happening to talk about the visual relevance if you can have vision without any eyes, and I can definitely attest to that. But I wondered how much of the visual cortex is programmed in a blind person to do other things approximately, and also would the brain map of a totally blind person who has never seen look significantly different from somebody who has total sight?
Yeah, beautiful question. Thanks, Linda. It turns out the brain is extremely plastic, and the term plasticity in the neuroscience context means that it's always rewriting its own circuitry. It reconfigures itself all the time. And so it turns out that in someone who's blind from birth, the part of the brain that would be the visual cortex has been encroached upon, has been taken over by all the neighboring functions, which is why someone who's blind has better sense of touch and smell and hearing. It's because those parts of the brain have taken over the territory that would have been visual cortex. And what we've just discovered in the field of neuroscience just in the last 10 years is how rapidly these takeovers happen. So if you take someone who has sight and you blindfold them, you completely blindfold them so that not a single photon of light gets in there, after 3 days, their visual cortex starts responding to touch and sound.
That's amazing.
That's how quickly it rewires itself. Yeah.
And science is learning from that, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, this is a big, in fact, this is the subject of my next book on plasticity that's coming out next year.
Do you see the day where, I mean, they're experimenting now with putting chips in for eyes and things like that. Mm-hmm. Do you see the day that that will truly be a common thing?
Yeah, it turns out the most amazing lesson about plasticity is that the brain is so flexible that it will accept whatever you plug into it, and it'll figure out what to do with it. So, for example, 8 years ago, nobody knew if these retinal chips would work, because essentially what you're doing is, let's say somebody's eye is completely, clogged up visually.
The optic nerve is gone. All right.
Well, actually, the optic nerve has to be there.
Oh, does it? Okay.
Yeah, the optic nerve has to be there, but let's say there's something wrong with your lens.
Cataracts.
You've got cataracts that are, yeah, just completely impermeable to light. Well, so what they do is, or let's say you have a retina, the part at the back of your eye that's completely degenerated. So the idea is you take a chip that's sensitive to photons, and you just plug it into the existing optic nerve, and you let the chip pick up on the photons and then send electrical signals back to the brain. Well, nobody knew if it would work because no one knows exactly what the code is that the retina sends to the brain. And so the hope was, well, maybe if we just send back these electrical signals, even though they're not in the natural language of the brain, maybe the brain will just figure it out. And that's exactly what happened. It turns out that no matter what kind of data you plug into the brain, it figures it out. So what this has led to is all sorts of new technologies to deal with blindness for people who want to be able to see. So one thing people are doing is putting electrode grids on the tongue of blind people. So imagine you have a little camera attached to your forehead, and the visual signals from the camera are getting turned into electrical signals on your tongue. And it turns out you can learn to see this way. Because even though your brain's not used to getting this sort of information from the tongue, it can deal with it. It can figure out how to deal with it. And so probably in the very distant future, we're going to plug things directly into the brain, like stock market data or weather data, and you'll be able to perceive the stock market or the weather patterns. Because whatever you plug in, the brain will understand. And this is how new senses get added in evolutionary time.
Do you think you'll ever be able to download true memory onto some kind of chip?
Yeah, I think so. I actually just wrote a piece on this, on this concept of silicon immortality, which is, can we actually download ourselves and live forever that way?
And just clone, right? You just clone, download, put it back in the new body.
Well, now, putting it in the new body actually turns out to be much more challenging than downloading it into a computer program and living in the matrix. I think that'll be the first step, because long before we understand the brain completely, we'll be able to Xerox it. And so imagine you take a perfect three-dimensional replica of the brain and, you know, with all the importance, this is well beyond our technologies right now, but in 50 years we'll do it.
Sure.
You take a three-dimensional perfect copy of the brain with all the proteins, the phosphorylation states.
Hold on to that, David, right there. I want to ask you about that, living in the matrix. We'll pick that up when we come back and take final phone calls next. Well, next hour, Dr. John Abramson joins us during our floating format, Overdosed America. So NASA's finally talking about its Kepler spacecraft, saying that it is finding new planets. Talked today about what they call a hellish planet discovered 1,000 light years away. Proof, they say, that this craft will be able to carry out its mission of finding other Earths in our galaxy, provided, this is their caveat, they exist. Let's come back and take some final calls with Dr. David Eagleman on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, David, before we go back to final call, so you can download into a computer one day, maybe 50 years from now, and live in the matrix. Would we actually feel as if we were in some kind of animated computer world?
Well, it would feel indistinguishable from your life now. If this all were, this is all science fiction at the moment, but it won't be in some number of decades. The idea is the thing that matters for your brain and your consciousness is not the wet biological gushy stuff, but the algorithms that are running on top of that wet gushy stuff. And so the idea is if you could reproduce your brain, whether out of beer cans and tennis balls or zeros and ones in a computer or anything like that, if you could reproduce the algorithms that are running in your brain, then that's you. That's got all your consciousness and all your memories and so on. And so the idea is you could be downloaded into a computer and surrounded with, what appears to be tables and coffee and food and people and so on, and you would never even know the difference. And some philosophers have taken seriously this very deep question about how would we know if we are already a simulation?
So true.
Yeah.
So true. Would we be able to watch our life in the Matrix over the computer screen? How would that work?
I suppose you mean downloaded a copy of yourself and you continued to live.
Right.
Yeah, well, in some sense, it would be very unsatisfying if you did that, because that would just be like another organism that's living in this other world, but you would still continue to die. And so it wouldn't feel like immortality in any way. So the trick of this, that sounds very strange, but the trick would be killing yourself the instant before you download yourself into the Matrix.
No way.
And then that's like beaming yourself. That's exactly what happens in Star Trek. You destroy yourself in one place and recreate yourself in another. Yeah.
Something would go awry. Let's go to Jim, truck driving in St. Louis. Hey, Jim, go ahead.
Wow, how you doing, George? First time I ever tried calling, and I get through.
I'm glad you're through. So whereabouts in St. Louis are you?
I am in an MCC truck right in front of Anheuser-Busch. I work overnight for AB.
Know it well.
I know you do. I know you're from the area.
You're right down there off of Broadway, aren't you?
I'm a quarter Lebanese, too, so I'm one of your biggest fans, bud.
Super. Thanks, Jimmy. Go ahead.
All right. I wanted to ask him if, in his research, he's ever come across a guy named Nassim Haramein. I don't know if he's the founder of the unified field theory or one of them, but, I mean, this guy is...
He's good.
Yes. I mean, I watched an eight-hour thing, I don't know, you know, on the internet, and I wanted more. You know, I want to meet this guy. I mean, the things he thinks about, this guy's the closest I've ever come to one of the guests on your show. I've been listening since 2003, since I've been driving a truck, and I can't say enough about you, George. Great show, and Dave, you're a great guest, one of the best I've ever heard.
Thank you.
Nassim, thank you. Heads up what is called the Renaissance Project Foundation, where he is dedicated to unifying all sciences and philosophies, merging them into an applied view of physics as it looks through nature. I got to get him on the program. Have you heard of him, David?
You know, I'm afraid I haven't heard of him, but I will Google him tonight. I'll try to find out what I can about him.
Nassim Haramein.
Okay.
Haramein. Got to work on that. Maybe he was on the program years ago. I'm not sure, but I haven't had him.
Okay.
Let's go to Knoxville, Tennessee. First-time caller. Alan, go ahead.
Hello, George. How you doing?
Good, Alan. Thanks.
Hey, I was wanting to know what y'all thought about the sciences that was talked about in the Bible, about the axe head swimming and different things like that and stuff.
Do you go into that, David?
Not my field of expertise, no.
How about another one, Alan? Go ahead.
Okay, what I was wanting to tell you, though, is I've locked into some of these things and tried them, and they really work and stuff, but you got to be totally obedient to the word before they even work. And the Lord's had me prophesy quite a few things to the government and things like that, and as soon as I prophesied them, the very next day they all come true, every one of them.
What's an example of something that you tried that worked?
Swam and stuff. I've tried that. You cut a stick and stuff, and you can't do these things, though, unless you're totally obedient to the word. But I cut a stick and threw it into a little bucket of water and had a lead weight at the bottom, and that lead weight come to the top.
Uh-huh. Well, there's a lot to be explored there. I mean, if that turns out to be true, that our modern structure notions of physics can be violated by belief in one of the 2,000 religions, that certainly would shake things up a lot. So it would be very important. I mean, if you can prove that and reliably show that, and circumvent the criticisms of debunkers, then that would be very important. That would completely shake up our notion of physics and what's going on in the universe.
What would you, David, if you had your preference, if one area of science could deal with anything that we've been talking about tonight and solve it, prove it, what would that be? What would you want it to be?
Oh, I mean, well, that's interesting. What we do as humans is we put walls between all the different areas of science, like physics and chemistry and neuroscience. We treat those as different problems, but they're all connected. And so I think the way science is going is the right thing, which it makes baby steps of progress on all fronts all at the same time. And with each passing decade, we get a better understanding of the fabric of reality and what the heck is going on around us. And so I guess I don't wish for anything other than the progress we're making, because none of us know exactly where it's going to lead. But, there's an interesting book called The End of Science, which wasn't that great a book, but the premise was interesting, which it starts off with an interview with Roger Penrose, the physicist, and the interviewer, John Horgan, said to him, "What would you really like to see happen in science?" And Penrose said, "Well, I'm really trying to get the grand unified theory of physics where we pull this all together." And Horgan, the interviewer, said to him, "Oh, well, wouldn't that be disappointing if you got that? Because it would all be over then. Then you would no longer be a physicist. Everything's understood." And Penrose's face dropped, and he'd never considered that before. But in some sense, if we ever get the grand unifying theory of everything, it'll be the end of science.
Absolutely. Okay, let's go to Kevin in Fairbanks, Alaska, west of the Rockies.
Hey, it's great to talk to you, George.
Thanks, Kevin.
Hey, David, man, you're a very smart guy.
Thank you.
One of those questions, be careful what you ask for, because you might get it, and then you're really stuck.
Okay.
So basically what it boils down to for me is what you guys are talking about is your point of consciousness within your body. And you have to decipher, you know, at what point you're going to take an action and what point you're going to sit by and observe. When you take into account your lucid dreaming, whether you think that's real or not, it's still information that gets inputted into your brain, and you still have to process it. And the more lucid those experiences, the more real those experiences, the more you question the reality of what you're actually doing each day. Does that make any sense to you?
Parts of it. Was there a central question there or a statement?
Well, forgive me if I'm wrong, though, Dave. Your expertise is in
neuroscience.
That's
neuroscience.
Right.
So I deal with a neurological disorder, which is basically migraines all the time. But I'm also a Tai Chi instructor, so I take the position that the more physical challenges I have in my body, having worked through a great deal in 15 years, I know that after a certain amount of time, the pain goes away and there is a positive resolution of the musculature and tendons and pain. Well, if you take that account into the brain, it's much the same process. You're going into areas of your brain that aren't really used, that are atrophied for whatever, you know, nutrients or lack of nutrients you've put in there over your life, and you have to kind of just be with the process until it resolves itself. And along with that, you get a lot more creativity and you get a lot more articulation in your ideas.
Right. So, okay, so I'm with you on that. Mentally stretching yourself is unbelievably important, and going to places in your mental landscape that you haven't been. This is actually one of the points of this book, Some, that I wrote, is to provide a mental stretch into 40 different directions of stories about what we're doing here that maybe people have never thought of before.
That's
and
right.
And the experience that people get from that, I think the reason this book it got into the top 40 books on Amazon, and I think the reason it became a bestseller is because people really like stretching into new places, and they're richer for it than everything else they do. They're just a little bit more limber mentally.
Well, it's so mundane. I mean, everyone, to me, it seems, is searching for that deeper meaning. And any way you can stretch your spirituality, your intellect, your boundaries, your compassion, your view of your, you know, humanity as in, you know, as what our potential is, that to me is what makes my juices flow.
Yeah. Well, great. You're exactly the kind of person I wrote the book for. It's exactly for that mental stretching.
Well, congratulations and good luck with the rest of it. And I'll shoot you an email. Maybe we can correspond.
Okay, great. Thanks.
David, do you find other countries are more advanced than we are or behind us with the study of work like this?
Oh, that's interesting. I mean, one thing off the top of my head, countries like Switzerland are allowed to study issues about drugs and hallucinogens and so on and their effect on the brain. And it turns out that stuff is a fantastic window into how the brain works, because with drugs of abuse or any sort of pharmaceutical, you know, we can figure out the molecular mechanisms, figure out what receptors they're binding to in the brain, how this works, and how you can get very different weird states of consciousness. It's a fantastic inroad into understanding consciousness. And yet, in the United States, because of some leftover puritanical spirit to it, you know, that you can't really do that sort of drug research. That just doesn't happen. So in some sense, in that sense, other countries are ahead of us. And I generally feel, as I travel around the world and talk about this book some, I feel like America's a little bit funny in its religious views, in that it tends to have such certainty. A lot of people here have such certainty about their religious take on things, whereas in other countries, I'm not sure why. Maybe there's just more diversity there, or maybe they've had enough religious wars and they're sort of tired of it. But they just tend to be a little bit looser in terms of how they think about things, and they're not as willing to assert as absolute truth the particular stories that they grew up on.
Okay, let's go to Fayetteville, Arkansas. Lee, it's you on Coast to Coast. Hi, Lee.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Okay.
And hi to Dr. Eagleman. I always count on people like you to foster deep thoughts from the audience. Great. Anyhow, so I've got a theory on the perception of time and why it seems to go by faster as we get older, and it's got to do with proportion. For instance, when you're 10 years old, 10 years is 100% of your life. But now I'm 40, so 10 years is only 25% of my life. Ergo, the 25% is a much smaller proportion, so it goes by quicker.
You know, I've heard this proposal before. We don't have any way of ruling that in or out. I think it might be related to the issue about memory, though, which is that when you're 40, you know, the things that happen to you at this stage in your life, there's sort of less room to store them, and more importantly, you've sort of seen the patterns before anyway. And so I think these are not exclusive ideas, this idea about the amount of memory you're laying down and what proportion of your life it accounts for. Because if there's something that accounts for a big chunk of your life, you're writing down a lot of memories about it.
Okay, do brain cells regenerate or not, David?
They do. There's something called neurogenesis, where you have the birth of new brain cells. For many decades, the dogma in neuroscience is that there was no neurogenesis. Now we know that in mammals, there in fact is. It's not clear the extent to which it happens, and certainly not in adults, but at least in young humans, that seems to be happening.
Let's go to Albuquerque, New Mexico, west of the Rockies. Hey, Susan, how are you?
Hi. Oh, yes. Well, I was kind of going to ask about the psychokinesis. I'm kind of plagued with it. Any kind of chemical like caffeine or sugar or all sorts of things, but I have no control over it. It just like messes up my life, so I just don't eat those things. But
Is your claim that when you drink caffeine, by psychokinesis, you mean moving things with your mind?
Yes, but it's like the whole world is like connected somehow in a bad way.
Ah, so that sounds a little different from psychokinesis. What exactly is are you able to move things or distort things with your mind, or is it a feeling of connection with the world?
Well, no, just bad things happen, and I'm connected with it.
Okay, I wouldn't call that psychokinesis. Would you, David?
No.
Well, what is it?
Bad luck.
Do you mean, Susan, that you've accidentally caused the thing, or do you feel as though you might have caused something bad to happen?
I'm not really sure, I'll just have a fight with somebody. It just brings up all my I just get really irritated, and I'll have a fight with somebody, and it's just because I've eaten this chemical. It wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Well, the interesting thing about us living with our brains is that we're influenced by invisibly small molecules, right? So when you put caffeine in your body or drugs of any sort or all the things that are universally administered like alcohol and cigarettes and so on, these little tiny chemicals change your behavior. They change your appetite for risk. They change your decision making. And so
it's like the outside world comes up to meet me.
That's interesting. Well, my advice would be avoid caffeine then.
Oh, yes, I do. I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, thanks, Susan. I'm going to be out in Albuquerque in November at an event for our affiliate KKOB, so I'll tell you about that in another month or so. Time for maybe one more quick caller, Santa Clara, California. Bill, go ahead.
Hello, hello.
Hi.
Hey, good evening, guys. I had a quick question. If you ever examined the Bible references as well as the Quran references, I noticed that in the numbers, they're depicting measurements and different variations on measurements and to whatever the reference is pertaining to. It seemed to measure out even in the fetus and some of Genesis and the human fetus and. I can't find these. I wrote down a lot of stuff here, but just like two or three months ago, I had a huge revelation in life and started examining all these things and all the stuff you're talking about. And
would that make him a possibilian, David?
Well, you know, on that, that's funny. I wanted to say you might think of fellowship of travelers since. It seems to refer that we are all light beams from certain different nebulae. There's like three, I think. The male and female, and then the interveners, the positive side, which is the Christ and Buddha and those that come here. There's very few of them, and there's many of the other two. And there's other things going on, it seems, right now, that there's other species involved in this, and there's some kind of big game. And we also, in the Sumerian Bible, it's referencing us exactly, depicting our complete structure of society from dating back to Greece.
Absolutely. Oh, my, we're already at the top of the hour. David, I want to thank you for being on the program.
Thank you, George.
And I shall be back in just a moment. John Abramson joins us as we talk about Overdosed America right here on Coast to Coast AM.